And improv was the best of all worlds. It was instant creation. You're constantly being creative. You're making something up on the spot. Plus, I still feel like we don't know exactly what we're doing. Like, I feel like we're still figuring it out. And to me, I was like, oh, well, there's space for me here. It's worthwhile for me.
Rob Norman is a Canadian improviser. He is the author of Improvising Now, as well as the instruction director at the Second City Toronto. In addition to producing the Backline Weekly podcast, Rob is a Canadian Screen Award winner for his performance on City TV's Sunnyside. In this shorter episode, me and Rob talks about improv history, building bridges over the sea, and Del Close, David Sheppard, and Keith Johnston. We talk about why Rob does improv, fear, and hobbies. We are also talking about roller coasters, flipping hamburgers, and to have a little chat with God. This is episode 75 with Rob Norman on Stick Around Long Enough. But is this something that you like?
There's absolutely nothing I want to talk about. I'm happy to talk about anything or find it as we go.
Okay, cool, cool.
Yeah.
Because I'm curious how it differs from, you know, being in Sweden. Is it the first time you're in Sweden?
I used to go to Copenhagen almost every single year before the pandemic. To the ICC, which is a great long-form theater. And one time we took a train across to Malmo for 3 hours. So I wouldn't say I've been to Sweden.
But you technically have.
Technically, I looked at a castle, and then I got back on a train and went back to Denmark.
So. Yeah, yeah. Just to check it out.
Yeah.
So what would you say is that, because I talked to another workshop participant yesterday, and like you're in a sense role of it also. It's very like, as a bridge, I think it's easier to grasp, like with the Toronto, right?
Yeah.
Toronto. So the scene there, and Johnstonian, and also Del Close, it's like, and I was in Chicago this summer, and I talked about Johnston, and there was like pretty few that knew about him, but everyone knows about Del Close, and here it's the same, like a lot of people know about Johnston, and a few know about Del Close. Now that's increasing, thanks to the improv comedy, and some people in Sweden that have brought the improv comedy to Sweden, I'd say. Just like a reflection of your, do you recognize yourself in that description, like a bridge of the two,
or maybe two worlds?
Yeah, or like the scene in Toronto, Backdog Theatre, are you there, anything, or?
Yeah, so I mean, Canada overall is a very interesting scene because we have a very interesting history. So Keith Johnston's from Calgary, Alberta, which is on the west coast. In Ottawa and Toronto, we had this guy named David Sheppard come up. He's from the Compass.
Yeah.
And he started something called the Improv Olympic in Toronto.
That is Viola Spolin's son, or is it Paul Sills that are? I always mix those two together.
So Paul Sills is Viola Spolin's son.
Okay.
David Sheppard worked with Paul Sills.
Yeah.
He was a son of an architect, and he went to Harvard and did all this stuff and decided he wanted to be in theater. So his theater was very focused on changing workers' rights, like waking people up to the real world, the real life conditions of class and all that stuff.
Improv for the people.
Improv for the people. His idea was, why don't we go do skits at a factory or at a mine on someone's lunch break, and we'll do plays for them to inspire them to rise up. That was his idea when he was younger. I don't know if I'm working in a factory, if I want to see people play Sit, Stand, Bend, but this was a long time ago. But he started a competitive improv, which what ended up becoming for us the Improv Olympic. It took off, and it now becomes high school wide. We do Improv Olympic. It's now called the Canadian Improv Games, and that all comes from David Sheppard.
Wow!
After he started that in Canada, he went down to Chicago, and with Sharna, they made the IO. So yes. Long history in Canada of improv, but it really is a melding of worlds, because you also have the French-speaking part of Canada, Quebec. They do their own style of improv, and that style that they've created, which is called Match, is all through South America. It's in Belgium. It's in France.
Yeah, so Cage Match.
I don't know if it's Cage Match, but it's basically the improv where it's either focused around hockey or soccer, where there's a referee, the points matter. So from the very beginning, and I should just mention Second City. So we have Second City in Toronto. And so all of these influences from Chicago go directly through that pipeline. So we had Del Close come up. We've had a whole bunch of people come up and kind of teach what they do in our community. So Toronto has always been a kind of meeting place for multiple different philosophies. And because of that, you had to be very well versed in all of them.
Yeah. But Keith then, like Johnston, how, if he was at the West Coast, at Calgary, he also came?
No. So what ended up happening is because Toronto is kind of the New York and LA of Canada.
Yeah.
So it's where a film scene is. It's where a theater scene is. All of these Johnstonian trained actors, when they want to move up in the theater scene or move up into film and TV, they have to move. And when they move, they brought all of his beliefs with him. And that's why Johnstone travels so well, because the people who love Johnstone really love Johnstone.
Mm.
And so people like Patty Styles. So these are folks who travel a lot and use Johnstone's work as a kind of basis.
Mm.
Also, like Keith's book came out early.
Mm.
Bob Odenkirk from Mr. Show, he went to the library, the bookstore, to find a book on improv, and Impro was the only book available.
Yeah.
So it influenced a lot of people in that 80s generation.
Yeah.
Del wrote his book a little bit later, and I think we would have probably influenced more newer generations.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But both of those books, Truth and Comedy, it's what I'm thinking on, and Impro, Keith Johnston from the 70s, more or less. Keith Johnston's books made an impact really on Sweden in the 70s. I think my mom actually read it, even though she didn't do Impro. You know, it was like a... Maybe it's like a book that you were supposed to read, because it was also some criticized against the school and the creativity, and it was also about masks and so.
Yeah. But
for me, when I started improv for some years ago, it was like too abstract or too, and it's the same with Truth and Comedy. It was like too broad in a sense. I wanted it. I guess it depends on who you are as a person as well. But that's why I also enjoy like your book and. As I told you before we started to record, I have a lot of books, and what I really enjoy with them is like it's pretty like if it's concrete in a sense, and it depends on what you want to do with the book,
yeah,
or what you want to grasp.
It's funny, when I started improvising when I was like 16, I started producing an improv show.
Oh my gosh.
And I was teaching other people how to improvise when I didn't know how to improvise myself.
Yeah.
And so my mom was a librarian, so I was like, just bring me back a book on improv. I have to run these rehearsals. How do I do it? And she ended up bringing back Truth and Comedy.
Mm.
So when I was 16 years old, I tried to do the Herald from Truth and Comedy.
Yeah.
And we ran that show for 3 years. And later, when I got to Second City and started taking classes, my first classes ever, I relearned how to do the Herald and realized the things I had taught them were completely wrong.
Mm.
And also, we had done everything to do with the Herald other than a scene. I didn't know how to perform in a scene.
Mm.
That was one of the issues. And I thought, oh my gosh, I would have loved to have a book that would have filled in the blanks of what I needed to be doing in those rehearsals.
Mm.
So Improvising Now is kind of a sister book to Truth and Comedy.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it takes like, when I read it anyway, I could like, it was for me such a perfect time for me reading it. I've done improv then for like 1 or 2 years maybe when I read your book. For me, it was like in the best possible way of like, I know this book suits me, so.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. But Rob, since you are, you're chatting a lot about improv and so do I. And I really, really, of course, love improv and, you know, have this drive about it and motivation. And as I said as well, I've listened to a lot of your episodes in the Backline podcast, which is great, really great. You don't have to ask, but like in personal, why do you do improv so much? Why do you
love? It's like my wife. Why do you do improv so much? Why don't you stay at home with the kids? Here's the answer. I was always interested in theater. I was always interested in like making things. I had also gone to art school. I was a painter for a very long time, a painter and a printmaker. And if you know anything about art history, artists did a really good job of kind of figuring out art. Like when I looked forward to what art was happening now, there wasn't a lot of painters who were having a massive impact in the art scene. Everything that we love happened from before. It's like before 1970s, 1950s is for me when art gets the most interesting. But for the most part, there didn't seem to be a lot of room for me to exist within that art form. Theater itself is great, a lot of work, a lot of prep, the stuff that I didn't love about theater. I love performing. I love the creative process. I love rehearsal, like figuring things out. But all the memorizing and the blocking and that process really bogged me down. And improv was the best of all worlds. It was instant creation. You're constantly being creative. You're making something up on the spot. Plus, I still feel like we don't know exactly what we're doing. Like, I feel like we're still figuring it out. And to me, I was like, oh, well, there's space for me here. It's worthwhile for me. One last little tidbit that pushed me over the edge. So I was always interested in theater. I was interested in improv. And in my school, if you did well in school, you got this prize. And so grade 13, our last year of school, there's like 10 people. If you got this award, the teacher would put you in a limousine. They would drive you all the way to Second City and you would watch a show.
What?
That was the prize. Yeah, it feels weird now describing it, but that's what happened.
What?
Yeah. And so I remember getting into a limousine, going all the way to Second City, watching a Second City show, and thinking it was so funny, being so amazed. And I remember on the ride home, I kind of had a little talk with my God up there, my gods, and said, listen, I know I want to be an actor. I know I want to be in theater. I don't need to be a movie star. If I can just do that for the rest of my life, that's the deal. I won't ask for anything else. I got that. I got to work for Second City, still do. I asked for more after that, but I was very happy that I got that. Like, if my life had ended the minute I got hired for Second City, I would have been like, I did it. I set out for my goal.
That's a very strong, like, I can recognize the feeling, like, I have this saying in myself when I really want something to happen, like, and I also have the chat with the God. And I said, like, you know, I don't really believe you, but if you do exist, please help me with this.
Yes. So for sure.
And I can be aware of myself, like sitting and crossing my thumbs there, wishing for that whatever shall happen will happen. Like if it's a show that I want to go through or what, like in general in life as well. But yeah, it's often very improv related for me as well, like the improv drive. But so also you are, in my experience anyway, improvisers are a lot of like, yeah, they come from the art. So they really want to create art in the spot. Or like be funny, or like want to be on the stage, want to act, and have these things which I think we all share.
Yeah.
Sense, but also you have written a book.
Uh-huh.
Like you ran a team when you were 16 for 3 years doing the Herald.
Yeah.
Really knowing what you were doing, the podcast, and you're traveling to Sweden now for like some really, and you have family. Like it's high committed, very high committed. It's like, is it for you improv and not?
Yeah, but I would say improv is a huge part of my life. In fact, for a while I was working on this TV show in Canada and it was great. It's kind of the dream. Got to work on like a sketch comedy show and I really loved it. I really loved the people I was working with. But after a long day of shooting, like 10 hours of shooting, I'd be like, oof, love to find a set. I'd love to go play a set, which is like very unusual because if you're doing comedy, normally you don't go, ooh, I'm hungry for more comedy. And that's when I realized, oh, I'm going to do improv forever. Like you could give me whatever you wanted to, give me a mansion, you could give me a TV show, a production company, whatever. I still need to do sets. I'm still need to gonna find a way to play for sure.
Is it the play that are central or in you or like in the improv? What? Like, yeah, or is it?
I mean, I think for me, it's still trying to figure out the problem. It's a problem solving issue for me.
Oh,
I think I did a show that was close to perfect like 10 years ago.
Oh yeah.
And I don't remember exactly what it is, but it was like a feeling where I'm like, ooh, during this period, I got very close to something. And I've done a lot of good shows since then. Real, like excellent shows, near perfect, but still haven't been able to figure out how to get to that perfect show I'm looking for. And so I think there'll be a day one day maybe where for me, I end up doing the perfect improv set. And at that point, I'll just hang on my hat and disappear forever because I'll be like, it's finished. The improv project is finished. I figured out improv. But for 20 years, I haven't been able to.
No, and have you been close?
No, it's been terrible.
Yeah, that's nice.
Like, no matter how good you get at improv, you still have to deal with failures.
Yeah.
You still have to bomb on stage. You do bad scenes. You do bad shows.
When, in like what areas are you feeling vulnerable on stage or like close? Because I guess you have a certain level of like threshold, like you can, you know what to do in this scene too, even though it sucks in the moment at the moment.
Well, as my good friend Adam says, your worst is someone else's best. So even when you do a bad show, probably it's not that bad. But you want to know when shows go bad and what they feel like. Let me explain. Number one, you're not afraid enough. So you're doing a show and you get too comfortable. Maybe you've done like 15 shows in a week and you just don't care anymore. You walk on stage and you don't have that kind of fight or flight response. There's no fear. There's no epinephrine going through your body. And so you're just kind of sluggish on stage and you don't really connect. You're not really alive. That happens to me sometimes. Sometimes I'm playing a scene where I'm trying to like push it in a direction, but for whatever reason, I'm not communicating well with my partner and we're on different pages and they're in one direction, I'm in another direction, and I'm trying to accept what the reality is. But in my head, I'm going, oh, I feel like it would be helpful for us if we went in this other direction. I can't force you. I'll do my best with what we have. And so that hurts. And then the third one is, I'm doing really well. Oh, audience loves me. I'm going to push. Maybe I pushed a little too far. Okay, yeah, I got to take a step back. Oh, that's too bad. I was on a roll. And if I just would have rested the game a little bit, then it would have been a perfect show. But I just pushed too hard. So those would be three things that I think happen to me still to this day.
Yeah, but that sounds like struggling in the scene in a sense. But I meant more like if you're feeling shake, are you on stage? Can you be on stage and notice that your hand is actually shaking of nervousity? No,
because
that happen?
Like the shaking piece comes from like a danger response. You're like, oh my gosh, I'm going to die or something bad's going to happen to me. My brain has been rewired to think that fear, that rush is exciting. I like it. I like that fear. I don't like roller coasters, but I have friends who do. So I think it's the same thing. If your relationship with roller coasters is good, then that fear is excitement. If your relationship with roller coasters are bad, then that fear is fear and you're going to have a bad time.
Maybe, and then it's just the experience of doing it a lot that reduces the fear and a good experience of like handling it in that sense. Yeah. If you were in my seat right now, what would you ask yourself? Is that a valid question? Do you understand?
Yeah. Well, we are in the same seat. So that's one thing I just want to point out. They're the exact same type of chair. So if you were in your seat, what question would you ask me? Well, Ilmar, my question for you would be like, yeah, I think I'd like to know a little bit more about you. Like where are you at with your improv life? Where are your struggles, do you think?
Rob, I would love to share, but we have so few minutes and I really want to, you know, max these.
But I guess I'm just trying to answer this question where it's like, what would you ask me? I guess it depends like what you would need, what you're looking for.
Yeah, of course. What I'm something that I want to do is, of course, share the improv philosophy, feeling I'm just glad that I'm not kind of a religious freak, because I would have been out yelling on the street with a speaker, you know, if I were in that sense. Because I feel the same urge in the improv. So that's why I want you to like tell all the Swedish people your philosophy or something. I don't know.
So let me give you the question that I asked someone when I was like a couple years in and someone was very established. I asked them, how do you do this professionally? How do I do what you do professionally? That was a question that I asked once. And the advice that I got was just stick around long enough. And I thought that was a really great way of thinking about being in the industry. It's not easy. It's not an easy gig. You have to deal with a lot of rejection. You know, you're not going to be the richest person on your street. There's a lot of like social dynamics that you have to kind of navigate constantly. So it's a very difficult gig. But he said, just stick around long enough and eventually you'll get where you need to be. I think it's true, because either in this industry, either people will move on or it'll be too hard for them and then they'll leave and you'll be the only one left. And I think that was a great way of thinking about it. And when I got that advice, it allowed me to deal with rejection better. I remember like when I got to university, I was doing a lot of improv and I was flipping hamburgers. I got to university, I was flipping hamburgers, minimum wage job. It was a bad job. and I was doing improv at night, and I was kind of bummed about it. And after I had that conversation, I flipped something in my brain. And the thing I flipped in my brain was, if the boss of Second City came to me and said, hey, I'm going to put you on main stage. You can do improv every night, but I'm corrupt. You have to come to my house. You have to wash my car every day.
Yeah.
Would you do that job? And the answer in my head was, absolutely. I love improv so much. I would wash a car. I would do anything.
Yeah.
And then I said, well, that's kind of what I'm doing right now.
Yeah.
I'm not getting paid for the improv part. I'm getting paid for flipping hamburgers, but I'm doing improv every night. And then all of a sudden I went, oh, I feel great about this. And I relaxed into that a little bit more. And it kind of gave me a resilience to keep going. I got a better job. I got a better day job. I got better shows. And then slowly started getting paid for improv and then teaching improv and then traveling the world doing improv and then teaching around the world doing improv.
Yeah.
So it really was a kind of piece about resilience and kind of constitution.
And small, like, incremental yeah. steps up the ladder, in a sense. It is a great advice or great philosophy, or just thinking of your life in that sense right now, already doing it. Because I also recognize the washing car, I would also, like, definitely do that.
Sure.
100%. And I'm doing the same now with the flipping hamburger in my life.
Yes. Yeah, and that's what you kind of need to do to kind of stay in the game.
But how do you, like, for me, it's conflicting sometimes with, the love life, if you can say that. You have a wife.
I have a wife, yeah.
You manage that.
I guess so.
I mean, to do improv and live on improv and still have a family, for me, that feels, I don't know why, but it feels like they are two opposites in a sense. It feels just hard to manage. Of course, it's possible, but it's on my head, in my hand right now.
Well, I mean, I guess... if you're in a rush, then you might have to make a value judgment there about what you really want to do. But I feel like as you do more and more improv and, you know, you become more established in the scene and the scene becomes fuller, you're going to spend less time thinking about improv. It's like doing the Herald. When you first do the Herald, you're thinking about, like, oh, well, what's the next beat? What am I doing? What's the group game? But as you do, like, your 10,000th Herald, you don't think about it anymore.
All right.
Well, once improv becomes your day job, you're not thinking about improv in the same way that you used to. You have more space to have more personal relationships. At a certain point, you're going to have to get a hobby. Like, that was hard for me to be like, oh, I'm doing so much improv right now. I need a break from it. I need to do something that's not improv related. Weird. That's a weird thing to do.
Yeah, and to force yourself there.
And for the record, it was podcasting. And then I got a job podcasting. So all of my hobbies become my jobs very quickly. And I'm always searching for new hobbies, which is a real problem I have.
But also a good thing.
It's good, for sure. But a hobby is supposed to be something that you do for fun, not that you make it into a job. You shouldn't obsess about it until it becomes your job every single time. That's probably not great.
But it's a symptom of, being very interesting in that what you do, in a sense, or like a curious in the field that you're diving into. But yeah, it's hard to find a hobby. I agree.
Yeah.
I only do improv.
For now.
For now, yeah.
I'm going to come back one day.
How long did it take before the hobby thought were like arriving? Or
Maybe like 15 years.
Right.
Maybe like 12 to 15 years of improv.
Okay.
With no hobbies, just improvising.
Okay.
And then...
Okay, so there's light in the tunnel.
Yeah.
At the end of the tunnel.
Yeah.
We have to round it up because we have the workshop.
Yes.
So I will still have you for like 8 hours or...
Yeah.
That's nice. But first of all, I get the impression of Rob that you are very, as a person, very, and I really like that, humble and kind. You are very humble and kind, and still have this professional attitude when you teach. That's great, I think. So because I'm also a teacher, I get a lot of inspiration by watching you teach as well.
You know, I think one of the number one problems that we have when we're improvising is that, especially with new students, I watch them rush to get on stage. It's like, can we get two people on stage? They rush to get on stage, and then the scene starts, it becomes stressful, and then they spend the rest of the time trying to get off stage, trying to end the scene, trying to twist out of it. And I think it has a lot to do with our own experience of discomfort and being like, I'm up here, it's going to be hard at some points, but what are the things I can do to make myself happy? Like, how do I make myself want to be up here? Is it object work that we're doing? Is it a character we want to play? If you really like wizards, do you want to play a wizard? Would that help you be happy in the scene? If you can find happiness up there, then you're going to be more watchable and you're going to be able to play scenes longer. Unhappy people can't improvise.
Yeah, That's great.
Huh? Some
great, a great advice from me for when I teach. It's super.
Oh, you can't use that for teaching. That's mine. So that's copyrighted. So you can't use anything I say, you can't use. Anything I say, I can use. Anything you say, I can use too, but you can't use what I use. So
I will make sure to quote you.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you, Rob.
Thanks,
y'all. Now we will workshop and I will open the door.
Oh, great. Can't wait.